from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Jennifer Glass, and this is On Point. 50 years ago, Martin Luther King Jr. stood before a crowd in Memphis where he delivered what would be the last public address of his life. He was in town to support underpaid sanitation workers who were about to strike for a living wage. King stressed the urgency of the situation to the crowd.
If something isn't done and done in a hurry to bring the colored peoples of the world out of their long years of poverty, their long years of hurt and neglect, the whole world is doomed.
He was shot and killed the next day. 50 years later, economic inequality still plagues America. But King's economic message is carried by a new generation. This hour on Point, voices from Memphis reflect on Martin Luther King Jr. You can join us on air or online. How are you marking this solemn day? What is Martin Luther King's message for a new generation, for those who marched with him? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter or Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Joining me now from Memphis, Tennessee, is Reverend Dr. William Barber II. He is a pastor who's leading the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival. The campaign is building on Martin Luther King's work to unite the poor and seek justice and equality for marginalized people. Reverend Barber, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Jennifer. I'm glad to be with you here from Memphis as we're preparing to have a rally on this morning.
And Reverend, tell us, what is the mood there in Memphis on this momentous anniversary?
Well, I think it depends on who you talk to. But one of the things that I've, along with the co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign National Call for Moral Revival, Reverend Dr. Liz Theo Harris, we've been saying is that the only way you can truly honor and pay homage to a prophetic voice that was not just about an individual, Dr. King was always talking about we, is to go to the place where they were slain, reach down in the blood, pick up the baton, and carry it the next mile of the way. We have cautioned people to have commemoration without reconsecration, to have remembrance without revival and a recommitment, because that is to actually do harm. People talk about the mountaintop speech. It really wasn't a mountaintop speech. That was the closing, which is why I like your opening this morning. He talked about blacks and poverty. He wasn't just dealing with economics. He was dealing with the triplets, racism, economics, and war, which had always been on his agenda. And he said to us in that speech, nothing would be more tragic than for us to turn back now. So we are trying to say, to honor Dr. King and all of those who were with him in the past requires that we take a real assessment of where we are at the present.
And where are we at the present, Reverend?
Well, in some ways, we've moved forward, and we're thankful for that. But in other ways, we have actually made worse. We have more poor people in this country now than in 68. Back to 140 million people are poor or working poor. That's 43% of the nation. And we're having elections where there's no discussion of poverty, only the middle class and the military. That's a tragic reality. We live in a time when we have less voting rights today than we had August 6, 1965, ever since the Voting Rights Act was gutted and the Ryan McConnell Boehner Congress has refused for 1,745 days to fix the Voting Rights Act, modern-day interpositional nullification. This has allowed state legislatures, more than 23, to pass voter suppression laws, gerrymandering, to block same-day registration, early voting, and automatic registration at 18. We have a president attacking immigrants on Easter Sunday when we remembered Jesus who welcomed immigrants. We have people able to buy unleaded water, gas, but can't buy unleaded water. And 63 cents of every discretionary dollar is going to war and the war machinery, four times more than it was when we were in Vietnam, and not to rebuilding our infrastructure and lifting the poor and paying living wages and full employment and guaranteeing health care for 37 million people that still don't have health care in this country. So we don't have time to merely glorify the past. We have to have what we believe is a moral revival, a poor people's campaign to address five interlocking injustices: systemic racism, systemic poverty, ecological devastation, the war economy, and one of the most tragic ones, the distorted moral narrative of so-called Christian nationalism that attempts to suggest that the only moral issues in the public square is where you stand on against gay people, against abortion, for prayer in the school, for guns, for tax cuts, and says nothing about the core values of justice, love, mercy, how we treat the stranger, the poor, and the least of these.
So, Reverend, you touched on so many issues that were core to Dr. King's message that entwined triplets of evil. He said militarism, racism, and economic injustice. Martin Luther King in 1966 telling his congregation in Atlanta, there are few things more sinful than economic injustice. You're the leader of the Poor People's Campaign. What is it and what are you trying to do?
Yes, and you're exactly right. In fact, in 1958, he preached a sermon at Dexter where he talked about the 99% being ruled by, over by the 1%. He always understood the connection between civil rights, economic rights, and dealing with the issue of war. The Poor People's Campaign, we have been traveling for 2 years, organizing locally. This is not about helicopter leadership. This is about people organizing locally. We now have more than 30 states with coordinating committees to have tri-chairs with poor people, clergy, and advocates at the center who are organizing to launch this campaign for 40 days, beginning on Mother's Day to the summer solstice, engaged in simultaneous nonviolent moral fusion direct action, a massive voter mobilization among the poor and impacted people, and building power among poor and impacted people. We are launching a movement, not ending it, but we're launching it for 40 days of action, and then on June the 23rd, a massive solidarity send-off rally, because we've got to build power from the bottom up. And on April the 10th, we are releasing a report, having a national briefing called The Souls of Poor Folk. Where are we 50 years after the first Poor People's Campaign? It is a sobering review, but it lays out what Dr. King would call our legitimate discontent. And we're organizing people, black, white, brown, red, young, old, gay, straight, Christian, Muslim, Jews, even people not of faith, but they believe in the moral arc of the universe and our constitutional moral values, because we have to have a movement, first of all, that will engage in the kind of moral, nonviolent direct action that breaks through the narrative. Because right now, the narrative doesn't talk about the poor. We had 26 presidential election debates, not 1 hour on poverty, not 1 hour on fixing the Voting Rights Act. None of those things are center place. Only a movement can push those back into the center of our public discourse. This is not about left versus right. It is about right versus wrong. And we are developing, if you will, an army of nonviolent activists who are willing to engage, put their bodies on the line, do massive voter registration, and build from the bottom up, and put a face on the facts so that we can turn the narrative and turn the consciousness of the nation, and then we can turn the agenda.
Reverend Dr. William J. Barber, carrying on the movement started by Dr. Martin Luther King on poverty so many years ago. He's the leader of the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival. Reverend, thanks so very much for joining us from Memphis.
Thank you so much. And ask your listeners to go to www.poorpeoplescampaign.org. They want to join and sign up to help us. God bless you.
Thank you. We have more voices from Memphis joining us in this conversation. Charles McKinney is a professor of history and a chair of Africana Studies at Rhodes College in Memphis, and he's the author of An Unseen Light, Black Struggles for Freedom in Memphis, Tennessee, out last month. You can find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Charles McKinney, welcome to On Point.
Hello, Jennifer.
Also joining us in Memphis is Michael Honey, author of To the Promised Land, Martin Luther King and the Fight for Economic Justice, out yesterday. You can find an excerpt of that on our website, onpointradio.org. He's the Haley Professor of Humanities at the University of Washington, Tacoma, where he teaches African American and labor history and Martin Luther King studies. Michael Honey, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Gentlemen, you're both in Memphis today, a momentous day. Charles, you live there. Tell us what it is like today.
Busy. Extremely busy. Memphis, the city of Memphis, has been thinking about and talking about and organizing on a number of levels to prepare for this day. The city has been trying to figure out how to make sense and make meaning of this commemoration, what to focus on, what to emphasize, what to de-emphasize. Activists have been doing the same thing with an eye towards highlighting some of the persistent areas and challenges that we still have, that we have yet to face, that we're still struggling with here in Memphis. And so so there's been a lot of activity on the ground.
Michael?
Yeah, there's my connection to this is as a former resident of Memphis and an organizer, but writing about Memphis for many years. And a lot of people are here from labor all over the country. And I've met people back from my hometown in Tacoma, Washington, from the International Longshoremen's Union and the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. And they're making really a pilgrimage to Memphis to renew organizing. And on February 12th, the 50-year anniversary of the Memphis sanitation strike, the fight for $15 an hour, people came from all over the South. And Reverend Barber's Poor People's Campaign came through. So people are using what I call the bonds of memory of 1968 to energize and organize and get people out to the polls to vote. The reactionary forces, if you will, in Congress out of power as much as possible.
Michael Honey, stay with us, and Charles McKinney. We're discussing Martin Luther King's Jr. life and legacy 50 years after his assassination in Memphis. You can join the conversation. Is America any closer to realizing Martin Luther King's vision of economic equality? If not, what's holding us back? I'm Jennifer Glass, and this is On Point.
I'm Linda Holmes. There's more stuff to watch these days than you can ever get to. That's why we make Pop Culture Happy Hour. Twice a week, we give you the lowdown on what's worth your time and what's not. Find Pop Culture Happy Hour on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Jennifer Glass. We're talking about Dr. Martin Luther King's economic message as we remember him 50 years after his assassination. You can join the conversation. How far have we come or not come since Martin Luther King visited Memphis for the sanitation strike in 1968? What do you hear 50 years on in King's message for economic equality? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guests today are Charles McKinney. He's a professor of history and the chair of Africana Studies at Rhodes College in Memphis. And Michael Honey, the author of To the Promised Land, Martin Luther King and the Fight for Economic Justice, just out. Before we go to them, though, I think we would like to look at what King said in his final speech. Many people remember it as the I've Been to the Mountaintop speech in Memphis, but Martin Luther King encouraged black people in that speech to use their money as a means of protest. He told them to boycott businesses like Coca-Cola and Wonder Bread because they weren't hiring African-American employees. He also encouraged African-Americans to have an insurance in and only take out insurance with black insurance companies in Memphis.
These are some practical things that we can do. We began the process of building a great economic base, and at the same time, we are putting pressure where it really hurts. And I ask you to follow through here.
We're on this momentous day. We're going to go to some of the callers here. Tom is calling from Detroit, Michigan.
Jennifer, how are you?
Fine, thanks. How are you today?
Good. You know, the way I see this is that I think that if Dr. King came back, he would be very disappointed in terms of our plight as a people economically. Now, he would be, you know, he'd like the way the laws have been passed about the discrimination and, you know, mm-hmm. and those kinds of things. But economically, as a people, he would not be satisfied.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, to me, in a manner of speaking, about, you know, I have a dream. I think that dream has become a nightmare. When you look at where Dr. King wanted us to go to and what we wanted to be, now, have we made progress? Yes, we've made progress. But there's a whole lot more progress in front of us to make. And I mean, number 45, Donald Trump, he has been the antithesis of what Dr. King stood for. And I mean, I hate to even put number 45's name even in a conversation with Dr. King, but he is a direct opposite in terms of what Dr. Martin Luther King wanted. You know, he just wanted, you know, the same rights that anybody has for us as a people, and even in terms of economics.
Thanks, Tom. Charles McKinney, do you agree? Would Martin Luther King Jr. be disappointed today?
Yes, I think he would be. If he came back to Memphis, he would notice, he would observe some conditions that are in many ways largely unchanged from April of 1968. African Americans in Memphis make 50% of what white Americans make. He would notice a rigidly segregated school system that is segregated by race and class. He would notice... he would be all too familiar with the high levels of police surveillance foisted upon activists and other Americans, right? So there's a number of things that he would find disappointingly familiar about Memphis. Now, that said, he would also, I would like to think, he would take heart in some of the gains, right, in terms of the expansion of the middle class, in terms of the expansion of black political power and economic power, but it's not enough, right? I think he would also take solace in the fact that there's a growing movement building in Memphis, a wide array of organizations coming together to push for the specific components of King's dreams related to economic justice, racial and social justice, environmental justice, and things of that nature. So that's what I think he would take the most solace in, was the fact that folks understood what he called the fierce urgency of now in terms of mobilizing and organizing and pushing for the rights that we all deserve, but so many of us do not yet have access to.
Michael, you've written about Martin Luther King's fight for economic justice, for equality, financial equality. What do you think he would make of where we are today?
Well, he'd be a severe critic, certainly of the current administration, but also of most of the administrations that we have had. He's talked about the right-wing coalition that was building in 1968, and I think is partly responsible for his death. He was talking about the military-industrial complex, which has only expanded, currently a budget of $700 billion for the military, $1 trillion to modernize nuclear weapons. He would be aghast and feel abhorrent of this direction. And then secondly, the anti-labor, anti-union thrust of right-to-work laws, so-called, in 28 states now that mm-hmm. used to be confined mainly to the South, mm-hmm. which take away a lot of the gains that the Memphis sanitation workers made in 1968 when they fought a strike for 2 months to get the right to a contract and dues deduction so that they could have an effective union. And that's what they're trying to take away these days. And King said, these menaces threaten everything decent and fair in American life. That was a speech he made to the AFL-CIO. And that's what we're seeing right now, that same kind of right-wing coalition. What's the answer to that? It's what Reverend Barber's talking about. It's what AFSCME is talking about, other unions, is building another coalition of people who are poor, the working poor, the organized workers, students, academics, religious people, people of color, people of any color, a multiracial coalition that tries to push in the other direction. My book, To the Promised Land, that was King's last speech, which we heard last night at Mason Temple, mm-hmm. talked about. Well, what was the Promised Land? King talked about a place of what he called in Memphis economic equality. And he didn't mean that we'd all make the same income. He meant that everybody would have a right to fair wages, a good job, or income.
And Michael, I want to go to one of Dr. King's speeches now, a year before his death. Then he laid out the case for a guaranteed income in his final book, Where Do We Go From Here? Chaos or Community, published in 1967. Here he is speaking about that idea in a speech that same year at Stanford.
If the Negro is to gain the economic security that he needs, now one of the answers, it seems to me, is a guaranteed annual income, a guaranteed minimum income for all people and for all families of our country.
And that is a man ahead of his time calling for a guaranteed income so that people could support their families. Michael, you were just speaking about that as part of his vision. It was really part of a pillar of his vision. Charles, you were just talking about how terrible things are in Memphis, that he hasn't really gotten that far. Do you think the Reverend Dr. Barber and his call for moral revival, the Poor People's Campaign, has a chance today?
Yes, I do. I think it's one of the great, as a historian of the civil rights movement, it's one of the great what if questions, right? If King had not been killed in April in our city, right? What if he is the front of a poor people's campaign? What if he is he can continue to play that role as being the connective tissue between so many different constituencies on the left and the middle and the right? And so, you know, I'm hopeful that there are a number of individuals, Reverend Barber certainly being one of them, who are in a position to lead, again, a national mass-based effort, right? Reverend Barber and the Poor People's Campaign, these folks are doing it right. He says that we're not helicoptering in. This is something that King understood. This is something that other activists and other organizations like SNCC and CORE and the Panthers, for that matter, right, is that you build movements on the ground. You build movements from the bottom up. You go knock on doors. Mm-hmm. You go talk to individuals. You build local. You build local organizations, and it's from there you amass your power, right? You don't swoop in and give a speech and then be surprised or disappointed that people aren't organizing a year after. After you've given the speech, this is how you do this work, right? And so they're doing it right. They're doing it in a grassroots way. They are bringing a lot of heat and light to localities. And again, this is from the Moral Mondays playbook in North Carolina that Barbara and so many others were instrumental in doing, right? You know, Moral Mondays, marches on Mondays, mm-hmm. To city halls, to the Capitol in Raleigh to demand specific things, right?
And these are those marches that have been going on, Charles, for years, is that correct, as the basis of this movement?
Right. Those marches went on for years and in terms of like electoral politics, right, results in making a hard right conservative governor, a one term governor, right, swinging some seats. But also Barber and King and others also understand the limits of electoral politics. Right. That's one of the things that gets lost in the buzz and in the translation. And we have to be careful when politicians start talking about King. Right. So there's more to this than getting particular types of people elected. It's about building bases of power that transcend electoral politics, building bases of power that are able to move both locally as well as regionally and nationally. Right. That can hold politicians and others to account who frequently, right, are working against the best interests of the most dispossessed in American society.
And that, of course, was the model that Martin Luther King did follow. We're going to go to Harrison now. He's calling from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Harrison, thanks for calling On Point.
Hi, Jennifer. Thanks for having me. I definitely think that there are, as a Black American, I definitely think there are, still, injustice and small amounts of racism out there. I think that, sometimes it's blown out of proportion. But as far as, like, things being the same as it was when Dr. Martin Luther King was alive, I think we've made tremendous strides. I don't see it the same way as some of your callers are saying. What I do see is this kind of stereotype. And I kind of went through this when I was growing up, as a Black American. It's like you associate being poor and being ghetto with being Black. So most of the youth nowadays, that's what they want. They want to try to be hard. They want to try to be ghetto. They want to try to be hood. So in return, it's like they don't want to join the military. You know, they're not that interested in being studious and going to college. Mm-hmm. So you're not making money, not because of the color of your skin, because, I mean, let's be honest, I've been in the military for a while. You know, I'm an E-7. You know, I'm disciplined. I've seen a black president, somebody actually that he wasn't born rich, but he was able to become president. I've seen black generals. If you want to be successful and go to college, you can. When I talked to my grandmother, who was alive, and she grew up around that time, it was totally different. You know, I had a friend of mine, his father passed away. His father was in the military for 20 years, and he retired as an E-6. My uncle was in the, like, back then in the military, it was a lot different. So it's like, I'm not saying that there's injustice now, but what I'm seeing in like most of the black, you know, community is that they're still associating being poor with being black, because I'm not poor, you know. And so the Reverend that was talking about the Poor People's Campaign, I think that's great. You know, I think that's great to help poor people. But like black Americans, you know, as a whole, I don't think we should associate us with being poor anymore. Back then we was poor because we couldn't.
Harrison, that's a very good point that you make, Harrison, saying that there still are opportunities out there, that the color of the skin isn't always the barrier. We're going to go now to Chris, who is calling from here in Boston. Chris?
Hi, Jennifer. Just wanted to say, as a union member, Dr. King really inspired me. And, you know, this right-to-work scam that he spoke about, you know, it started off as a racial thing in the South. Vance Muse started a supposed Christian association in the South. And it still persists to this day, the right-to-work scam that this government is supporting and this president is supporting. So I appreciate Dr. King's efforts, and I try to listen to his speech every April 4th.
Thank you, Chris. Markel is calling from Springfield, Massachusetts.
Yes. One comment I'd like to make is that the Jim Crow laws and the forced segregation, one visible factor that it nearly destroyed the black entrepreneur, the black businesses in the community. Nowadays, it's a dying institution. It's been supplanted by the big box, the big supermarkets, the CVS, the pharmacies, the fast foods, and now some of the Home Depots that are springing up in the place like where I grew up in Newark, New Jersey. And furthermore, just the other day, the president said in Ohio that black unemployment has been the lowest in history. Well, I kind of challenge that that premise. That most of those jobs are low pay, no benefit, service jobs with no insurance, no compensation.
Mm-hmm.
And but the main point I wanted to say is that the black entrepreneurship across the country it just nearly has been destroyed. When you go into black communities, you virtually hardly see any more black owned businesses.
That's an important point. Thank you, Markel. Markel makes the point that there are still problems in businesses. Michael, let's talk about that. One, saying that Martin Luther King's legacy means we have unions today and better working conditions. Markel saying there are still problems for black entrepreneurs. Michael? We may have lost our line to Memphis. Let's go back to Maria. She's calling from Yellow Springs, Ohio.
Hi, Jennifer. Thanks for taking my call. I was born in December of 1968, so I was in my mother's womb when Dr. King was assassinated, and I just recently asked her how she felt about that, because it seems my whole life has really been a continuation of Dr. King's dream and legacy, you know. And she, of course, was devastated by the loss of the greatest American we've ever produced, truly the greatest American hero. Dr. King Day is my favorite holiday. It's the most important American holiday that we have in some ways. And Yellow Springs, Ohio is a town really rich in the history of activism. Coretta Scott King went to college here. And in fact, the first house I ever lived in Yellow Springs was where Dr. King had lunch the day he gave the commencement speech at Antioch College in 1965. And in fact, that speech was the first speech he gave after he won the Nobel Peace Prize. And so it was his first world speech. And I think that if people haven't ever heard that speech, they should go to WYSO's archives and check it out, because it's a really amazing speech. The first few paragraphs were written and the rest was came right out of his heart.
Maria, I'm going to interrupt you. We're running out of time. Thank you very much for your remembrances. We'll be back with more guests. You can join the conversation. 50 years on, are you still standing with Martin Luther King Jr. on a guaranteed annual income? I'm Jennifer Glass, and this is On Point.
NPR's Code Switch tackles race and identity in America with humanity and humor. You'll laugh, you'll learn, you'll get uncomfortable. It's worth it. Find Code Switch on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Jennifer Glass. We're remembering Martin Luther King Jr. on the 50th anniversary of his assassination. You can join the conversation. Do you see echoes of his activism in Black Lives Matter, the Women's March on Washington, or the recent March for Our Lives against gun violence? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guests today are Charles McKinney, professor of history and chair of Africana Studies at Rhodes College in Memphis, and Michael Honey, professor at the University of Washington, Tacoma, where he teaches African American and labor history and Martin Luther King studies. Before we get to our guests, I want to get to some of the comments on our website. Thinkin15 saying, Martin Luther King Jr. was a truly courageous man with a message that America had to hear. The shameful, unchecked way that blacks in this country were being oppressed and terrorized had to be confronted and changed. America will never be great until it learns to stop hating. And from Ray in Vermont, we saw a good deal of progress in dismantling some aspects of institutionalized, legalized discriminations against many African Americans during Dr. King's active years. But we can still see some groups are still not treated as equally as they could be. The dream is still unrealized. Charles McKinney, you alluded to that earlier, the dream still unrealized. What would you say to King's followers today?
Well, and I'm also thinking about one of the comments of one of your callers who mentioned that, you know, he is from a pocket of the black community that's doing really well, right?
Yes.
And I think that's really I think that's a really important point for us to sort of to think about, right? In terms of, you know, there's a dramatic expansion of the black middle class from 1968 to now, right? A factor of four, I believe, the black middle class has grown. At the same time, the rates of poverty in black America are virtually unchanged, right? So when Skip Gates was asked to talk about a scholar, Skip Gates was asked to talk about this moment, he said, you know, literally it's the best of times, the worst of times, right? Mm-hmm. And so what we have to understand also is that the people who were in the position early 1970s, who were in position to take advantage of this new legislative terrain, the people who were able to take advantage of the passage of a Civil Rights Act, take advantage of affirmative action, take advantage of the doors that had been blown open for African Americans, those folks who were in a position to take advantage of those gains were able to do so, right? So, for instance, I am the son of two college-educated African Americans. Right. My parents, both born in Arkansas in the 1930s. Hey, Mom. Hey, Dad. both born in Arkansas in the 1930s were able to go to college. Mm-hmm. And since they were able to go to college, right, it's a generation, you know, college, we know college is a generational thing. Their children, my sister Teresa and I, were also able to go to college. Now, my parents grew up, having every once in a while to pick cotton. Right. You know, they grew up as occasional tenant farmers.
Wow.
Right. Had Charles and Lil McKinney been remained chained to the land, right, as so many of their neighbors were, right, if they'd never seen the inside of a middle school or if they had never seen the inside of a high school, right, there's a really distinct possibility that I would not be a college professor now. Right. So I was in a position to take advantage. My parents were in a position to take advantage of those gains. And then that generational benefit, that generational wage passed down to me. So what we have to remember is we have to think about the millions of Americans, right, particularly African Americans in this context, who did not have access to these gains. What does it mean to be able to go to college if you've never seen the inside of a middle school? You're not going to college if you've been literally chained to the land because you got to help feed your mother, your father, and your sisters and your brothers, right? So that's the thing that we have to be mindful of here in terms of In terms of how those benefits, in terms of how those benefits are playing out. And the other thing I would say really quickly is that when we look across so many sectors, we still see sort of rampant disparities, right? And so in terms of unemployment rates, right, the unemployment rate for African-American college graduates is double that of the unemployment rate for white college graduates, right? You know, black women across all socioeconomic lines are more likely to die in childbirth than white women, right? You know, again, educational disparities along the in that nexus of race and class are still adversely impacting black and brown students in American society. So while at the same time that I can, you know, I personally can sing the, you know, extol the virtues of this movement, I am intimately connected with family members, intimately connected with communities who have not been able to access the benefits of this movement and are still mired in all of the in many of the challenges and are still confronting and grappling with many of the challenges that poor black people were confronted with in 1968. And so that's the thing that we have to keep in mind when we have these conversations.
So successes build on successes. But a new study out by Stanford, Harvard, and the Census Bureau finds that even in the wealthiest families living in some of the best neighborhoods, white boys with similar backgrounds do better than black boys. So still a problem today. I want to go to David. He's calling from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. David, thanks for calling On Point.
Hi, Jennifer. I just want to make the point that, you know, I completely support Black Lives Matter. I supported taking the knee, you know, at the NFL, certainly the gun control issue. But under this administration, I mean, we have got to have some sense of urgency on the part of an administration. And Trump has normalized racism to a degree that is mind-boggling. The Attorney General, who has a historically documented problem with racism, is unraveling all of the advances made under Obama, knowing full well that these changes in laws are going to affect blacks and minorities, period. Trump is appointing all kinds of ultra conservative judges to lifelong positions. We're going to suffer the consequence, I fear, of this administration as it pertains to racial equality for years to come, regardless of if he is elected to a second term.
Thank you, David. An important point there. Michael, is this administration rolling things back? Do you see any signs of that? Do you see any parallels from your studies of Martin Luther King's time?
Oh, obviously. Dr. King, in his last book, Where Do We Go From Here, said, you have to remember that white folks have been backlashing against black people from the very beginning. The backlash is not new. So we always have this wave of whenever progress happens, there's a wave to turn it back. And, you know, Ronald Reagan led the wave against organized labor in the 1980s and set off a whole chain of events that shattered a lot of the unions in the United States. And we're suffering from that today because why do we have low wages? We have low wages because people aren't organized to push up their wages. Profits are going up. Wages are mostly not going up. Trump himself, during the campaign to get elected, said wages are too high. He's thinking of Mar-a-Lago, where he pays below a living wage. We also have the big box stores that one of your callers referred to. Those people aren't making living wages. There's building new complexes even here in Memphis with public subsidies where the wages are going to be not living wages. So that's why we organize people, why we organize labor. That's why we organize unions. That's why we organize the Poor People's Campaign. The problem of poverty is very simple. Either you have no job, or you have a job, but it doesn't pay an adequate income. Low wages or no wages. And that's what we've got to do something about.
And I want to hear from one of those workers. In February in Memphis, workers took to the streets to advocate for a living wage, just like sanitation workers did in Memphis 50 years ago. Here's Sepia Coleman. She's a home health care worker, speaking about why she marched.
We're still fighting for the dream, and the dream for equality, the dream for justice and for equal rights for women especially minority women. As a home care worker, I cannot make it off of $7.25. Nobody can. I definitely need it. I currently work three jobs, which is sad to say.
So much of Martin Luther King's pillar of economic justice being fought today in Memphis, where he went to have that battle 5 decades ago. Let's go to Leroy. He's calling from Baltimore, Maryland. Leroy, you're on Point. Have we lost Leroy? How about David? David is calling from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. David, you're on Point. We seem to have some problems with our phones today. Charles, let's talk to you. You just heard from Sepia there about wanting to earn a living wage. That's something that Martin Luther King was fighting about. We've talked about it earlier in the show. What can they do? They marched in February. They're trying, you say, grassroots organization is part of it. But, you know, they also have to pay their bills and take care of their families. How do you have time to organize when you have to just make do and live?
That's a great question, right? And that's the perennial question that organizers have to face. You know, Fannie Lou Hamer had this question, right? I mean, you know, activists across the generations have had to figure this out, and it's hard, right? I can't get off work, so this work's gonna take place on the weekends. This work's gonna take place in the evenings, and that's why you have to build your coalition, right? That's why you want college students who can join you. That's why you want folks who've got more flexibility, like college professors, right? Who've got more flexibility in their schedules to help build your movement. The other thing that I wanted to say really quickly is that, you know, this is a perfect example of something that King sort of warned us about, and the way in which race has been weaponized to take out, right? The way race is used to lower the bar all across the board, right? We don't want a vigorous and vibrant social safety net because we don't want to give support to these lazy blacks, right? These lazy black people are on welfare. Therefore, we need to reform welfare. You know, healthcare, right? You know, you've got folks, you know, amazingly, right, saying, you know, I don't want Obamacare, but wait a minute, I'm a beneficiary of Obamacare, right? So you've got West Virginia workers overwhelmingly voting for the guy who says, I'm going to repeal Obamacare. You know, a component of which is, you know, the black lung, legislation that helps the widows whose husbands have died of black lung to receive their benefits, right? So you literally are voting for the guy who wants to kill your benefits because you've associated Obamacare with these racial codes, right? You know, in these really sort of explicitly racist ways. And so this is the way in which race infects so many other sectors of American life, and it's something that we have to name, right? And this is something that King was also very good at. He says, look, this is dragging all of us down. It doesn't make sense to ignore the hole in the boat if the hole is not in your area of the boat, right? The boat is going to sink, and we're all going to drown. So if we don't address the issues, and if we don't address the ways in which these issues have been structured, then, you know, then we're not going to get anywhere, right? So the right to work states, where are those states located? Those states are overwhelmingly located in the American South. Right. So I'm looking over at Mike Honey to get confirmation on that. So, there's a legacy here. Right. We're talking about a legacy of segregation. We're talking about a legacy of inequality anchored in slavery. Right. And so these are very uncomfortable conversations to have, particularly in the American South. But there's a conversation that we do definitely have to have in terms of why, right, our contemporary society looks the way it looks. And one of the central reasons it looks the way it looks is the way in which race has been deployed, right, by conservatives and by the right to drive down wages, to drive down access to health care, to drive down access to home ownership, and to drive down access to the ballot box. Right. So that's something that we've definitely had to have to keep in mind.
I want to go now to a comment from our website, a rather provocative comment from Hello Kitty 580. She says it was one thing for Martin Luther King to talk about racial injustice, but it was a completely different thing when he started to criticize the capitalist system. That was entirely unacceptable to the powers that be. Michael Honey, was that economic attack on the capitalist system and economics really a problem for Martin Luther King? We're going to go to Leroy. Actually, we were going to go to the phones. We're having problems with our line from Memphis. Leroy is calling from Baltimore, Maryland. Leroy, thanks for calling into On Point.
Good morning, Jennifer. I'm sorry. Hello, Jennifer.
Hi there.
Okay, if Martin Luther King were alive today, he would be happy, but not as happy as he would be, because we have made a lot of advancements, but we have not gone as far as we could go. And I'm going to use myself in particular about this particular story. I'm lucky because I happen to get myself into a union. And when you're in the union, you have collective bargaining. You have people to speak for you. Okay, I've been in the union for 37 years. A gentleman got into the union who had only had 15 years in the union versus this is a black gentleman, mm-hmm. versus a white gentleman who got in the union and he only had 10 years. Okay, the white gentleman was driving the tractor trailer. But the black gentleman says, no, I have more seniority, so I want to drive the tractor trailer. The company couldn't stop him, so what happened is they put the black gentleman on the tractor trailer, but they gave him one of the most difficult routes you could have. So he came to me and he said, I know what they're doing. They're mad because I want to drive the tractor trailer with my seniority. And I told him, yes, this is what they're doing, but this is what you can do back to them, and you're not doing anything wrong. If they're putting you on a tractor trailer and you have more work, stay out there longer and you make more money, because that's what will stop them. They're trying to come at you one way. Okay, you're driving a tractor trailer. Take your time. Make more money, because that's the way to get at them. Take the money from them. Even though you got to go through all the crap with it, take the money from them.
So give yourself some political, some economic strength. Leroy, thanks so much from Baltimore, Maryland. Michael Honey, I want to go to a final question from you. You end your book with a question, where do we go from here? What do you think?
Well, the book I just did, To the Promised Land, Martin Luther King and the Fight for Economic Justice, is aimed at getting people to think differently and to think anew about what they think they know about Dr. King. And it's not something that is just about history. It's really about the present. Dr. King was talking about all along the interconnection between racism, war, poverty, and violence. Until we break those connections, until we build an alternative of nonviolence, agape love, as he called it, we're not going to break this cycle.
Michael Honey, professor at the University of Washington, Tacoma, and author of To the Promised Land, Martin Luther King and the Fight for Economic Justice, thanks so much for being with us today. And Charles McKinney, professor at Rhodes College and the author of An Unseen Light, Black Struggles for Freedom in Memphis, thank you for being with us from Memphis.
Thank you.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jennifer Glass. This is On Point.